Oh my gosh, here we go. I heard that.
Oops, sorry about that.
So you got a list of the questions, Pete, and I know we might have a follow-up question here or there to some of them as well. And the group's problem of practice centered around teacher capacity and doing the best they can with teacher-level data to increase student achievement. So the first question is, what are your highest leverage recommendations for building teacher capacity for effective data analysis?
Well, I appreciate that question, and I totally understand where it comes from. And here's something that I have found in my travels and the work that I have done around leadership and around teacher effectiveness, is that the high leverage lists that John Hattie has produced through his meta-analysis, and you know, Bob Marzano and the other great researchers out there that have compiled data around what makes a teacher effective. Well, you've got all those lists, you've got all these characteristics, and you and I both know, and everyone that might be listening to this knows that teacher A can use a particular instructional strategy, and teacher B can use the same instructional strategy, and they can use the same lesson plans and the same materials and be working off the same data sheets. Teacher A can get exceptional results out of her lesson, and teacher B can get mediocre at best results out of her lesson. And the question becomes, what truly is the difference? And the work that I have done with some of my co-authors and some of the co-researchers has gone deeper than just what are our teachers doing, and it has uncovered what are our teachers thinking, and the thinking that drives the doing really becomes the most essential component of this entire equation. So whether we're talking about data analysis or cooperative learning or differentiated instruction, whatever we might be talking about, the way our teachers think and reflect on their practice is going to be the number one determinant of how effective and successful they are in their classrooms. So when we have this conversation about the highest leverage recommendations for building teacher capacity about anything, I am going to default to how can we build our teachers' ability to think more critically, more frequently, more accurately about the work that they're doing, about their curriculum, about their students, about the data they've got, about the goals that they're trying to accomplish, and the instructional strategies and all the different elements of effective teaching. How can we help them to think more critically about those so that their practices follow? So that's kind of an overview of the thesis. And I know that through some of the other questions, I'm going to go a little bit more depth about what exactly that looks like.
Okay, that's great. So what are some of the pitfalls in regards to the data analysis that aren't often considered when people try to do this, something like this, for the first time?
Well, you know, there's a couple big ones. One is the over-collection of data. And we do a pretty good job, in American education in particular, of warehousing and storing incredible amounts of data. And we've got more than we ever need. And so in our zeal to collect information and have as much knowledge at our fingertips as possible, we frequently are collecting data that we're never going to use. And that's something that overwhelms teachers when we're assessing kids all the time. We're, you know, giving them tests, scoring this. And you know the teachers that grade every single assignment that comes through the inbox. That's exhausting. And if we're not really doing anything with that information, then why are we doing that? And then we end up getting what we call drip syndrome. You may or may not have heard of that, the data-rich information poor, where we've collected a ton of stuff and we don't really use it. We don't use it to inform our instruction. We don't use it to provide feedback to our kids about where they are in relevance to their goals. And when we have too much on our plate, it's hard for our teachers, especially at the beginning of this process, to sift through it and figure out, well, what's the most important information? Which is the information that's related to what I'm truly trying to accomplish with my kids and in my class and in this lesson right now? And how am I going to use this information to modify the lesson for tomorrow or provide an intervention for a student that's struggling later today? And when we have too much information, that's when it becomes overwhelming for folks. So I think that's probably the number one thing, is having too much data and not knowing exactly how to use it and how it's relevant to the work we're truly trying to accomplish.
Well, I have not heard of drip syndrome, but I just wrote it down, and I will be stealing that from you if you don't mind.
Well, I stole that from somebody. I think it was Rick Dufour, the late, great Rick Dufour, that first presented it that I heard. So,
okay.
Yeah, there it is.
So how do you assess skill over will, and what are some suggestions for moving and coaching people who fall into one of those categories?
Yeah, that, you know, that's a terrific question. And skill will matrix is a great way of looking at teachers and the kind of the attitude and the competence that they bring to the table. Another way is a model that my co-author Elisa Simmerall and I have developed that really addresses that reflective ability that I was mentioning before. And here's the part where I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about where I started. We've created a tool called the Continuum of Self-Reflection that describes the differences in how our teachers reflect on their professional practice. And embedded in that tool is the very thing that you're talking about. So those components of, do the teachers have the information they need? Do they have the skills they need in order to fulfill the task and to analyze data, to have the right data, to make appropriate decisions? And do they have the motivation, the inspiration, the desire to get after that? So those are embedded in some of the stages of our continuum, and there are four stages of the continuum. And I'll just go through them really quickly. The first one is called the unaware stage, and that's a place where, as a teacher, you just don't know something. And it's perfectly okay to not know something, because at some point in our trajectory of our professional careers, we didn't know everything. I mean, now we know everything, but at some point we didn't know something. So we're not 100% sure about how our students best learn. We're not sure about how to collect the data that are exactly what we need to move forward. We're not sure exactly what the learning targets are and what the goals are that we're trying to accomplish. Whatever those little components, I don't know how to use that teaching strategy most effectively. Whatever that piece is, we just don't know it. And so we're operating off of the best of intentions and doing whatever we do know. The next stage in our continuum is where we've learned a little bit and we've gained a little expertise or a little experience. And now we have this, what presents itself there is what we call a knowing-doing gap. And that Sutton and Pfeffer first brought that up in 2000. This idea of, if you know better, why don't you do better? Well, it's hard to create new successful habits when you have already created habits that maybe aren't so successful and aren't moving us in the right direction. So at this conscious stage, we've learned about data analysis. We've learned about how to conduct a data-driven dialogue. We don't necessarily know how to then incorporate that into our lesson planning or how to weave that into the lesson for tomorrow in practice. So we need that consistency. We need that intentionality of being very thoughtful and very deliberate about making sure that those components are included in our lessons. And we call that the conscious stage. The next piece, or the next stage on our continuum is where we have started to build some consistency in our practices as a result of our consistency in our thinking, which then puts us in a spot where we have to start analyzing whether or not it's working. So are we being successful? So I'm using these data meetings with my teammates to construct intervention plans, and then are they actually helping? Are kids succeeding at higher rates as a result? Are we able to fill in gaps that kids are presenting with as a result of these interventions, as a result of these lessons? And then the next stage on our continuum, we call that the action stage. The next stage in our continuum we refer to as the refinement stage. And in that stage, we are really conscious of every little thing that's happening in our classroom, every look that a student has that would indicate to us that there's some confusion and we need to address that immediately. And as teachers, we're able to adapt and adjust in the moment, in the trenches, and refine our practices as they're happening. So those four stages describe the differences in how folks think about their work. And then to complement that, what we put together a series of coaching tools and feedback prompts and ways to partner teachers together to support their reflective growth to move them along that continuum. So the two things that you addressed, skill and will, they tend to come up. Skill tends to come up in the unaware stage when we haven't yet learned the skill. And as educational leaders, as administrators, as instructional coaches, as department chairs, it's our obligation to provide that information and to provide that training, to provide that professional development in a supportive, ongoing, job-embedded manner so that our teachers learn the skills they need to move forward. And then the will piece, if we're finding a teacher that is struggling with the desire to get after it, we usually find that in what we call the conscious stage, which is that knowing-doing gap where I'm not engaged in the work for some reason. And it's our obligation then as instructional leaders to dig a little bit deeper and find out what's the reason. If it's a will issue, if there's something that's impeding a teacher's performance or implementation of a skill or a strategy, why is that happening? And that's the piece that then we need to find out so that we can help remotivate, reconnect, re-energize our teachers back to where they need to be.
Okay. So when there's, and I know, like, when an overall climate of the building is kind of suffering, how do you kind of motivate teachers to focus on, in this case, it's data to improve instruction, but it could be any initiative, really.
Yeah. Well, if the climate of the building is suffering, we need to be doing some work on climate. And part of what's going to address climate and the initiative and the, and in this case, data analysis, is going to be bringing back the why, the purpose. You know, I heard a phrase not too long ago that we don't get burned out because of what we do. We get burned out because we forget why we do what we do. So if there's a way for us as leaders to continually reference the why, the purpose, the mission, what compels us to get to work every day, what is our common goal, what is it that we're all fighting towards, that helps with climate, that helps with keeping initiatives on the forefront. I mean, too many of us have lived through that whole this too shall pass idea where an initiative is launched and then we kind of just get into the grind of doing it and then it's an expectation that we're doing it, but we don't really rediscuss or keep that why front and center. And there's nothing more powerful than having that purpose in the forefront of our minds, right there in the frontal lobe where we can see it and we can position everything we do around it and ensure that the work that we're doing is leading towards it. So I would say bring back the why. Why is it important for us to look at data? Why is it important for us to have a healthy work environment? And what are some things that we can do to help, you know, improve that and move that forward? When we have that why put in front of us, we're much more likely to find success.
Okay, so this is a question that's actually not on there, but it's kind of like a follow-up question.
What about the
opposite? Like when students are achieving and scores remain within proficiency bands, how do you motivate and challenge students and teachers to kind of change and adjust their practice to increase achievement? Because as we know, sometimes there's not that sense of urgency.
Right. And, you know, and I've seen that a lot with schools that are higher performing. You know, the issue there is when is enough enough? When do we get complacent and why does that happen? And I think that's a conversation that principals can lead with their faculty, whether it's at the department level or even one-on-one with teachers or at the whole staff level, is to have that, just to have that honest discussion and say, hey, we're doing well. You know, we're scoring well, we're doing such and such, and these are the scores we're getting, and these are the rates that we're getting. Is that enough? Are we okay? Like, do we sleep well at night knowing that this is what we're getting, and that's what it is? There are places where you're getting 99. You know, let me tell you a quick example. I was working with a school district in Kennewick, Washington, a decade and a half ago. And it was the home of the 90% reading goal. Their school district was getting 70% proficiency across the board every single year. They kind of plateaued. And the school board was not okay with that. They thought, you know, we need to do a little bit better. I mean, 70%, that's not bad, but they felt like they could do better. So they had an executive session, and they presented a 90% reading goal district-wide. This is for elementary folks at the time. Well, the principals were in an uproar because they were averaging 70% for years, right? Now, all of a sudden, it's at 90. They got on board, and then teachers were in an uproar, and eventually they got on board. And at one of the schools in particular, Washington Elementary School, I remember this, Dave Montague was the principal, and he had a faculty meeting when the test came back that 99.4%, every single kid minus one, tested as proficient. And they had a big party. They had cake and they had balloons and they had this big celebration. And about 5 minutes into the celebration and the recognition, one of the teachers stood up and you know, tapped her glass with a pen or a knife or something and said, "Hey, we need to have a conversation." And you know exactly what happened. She said, "What about the one? I mean, we can celebrate 99% of the kids, but there's one family that has this one kid that is not proficient. And so if that family were here right now while we're celebrating our success at being 99%, and she looks at her kid and they're looking at 0%, what are we going to do about this?" So they turned that party into a work session where they brainstormed interventions and they figured out what they could do for that kid. And that's the kind of mindset that we need to establish. And somebody has to lead that. In the absence of a teacher that is going to stand up and rally the troops together, a principal's got to do that. An assistant principal's got to do that. A department head's got to do that. Somebody has to be the flag bearer of that sense of urgency. Because even when we're at super high percentages, there are kids that are falling through the cracks. There are kids that are not succeeding. And we can't just write that off to, "Oh, the kid has a bad home life," or, "Oh, the kid has a terrible attitude," or, "He's not interested and he'll never be successful no matter what we do." We have to be willing to say, in order for us to get to 100%, we have to go through every single child on our roster.
Yes. Thank you for that. So how do you balance placing constant pressure on teachers to maintain a relevant data-driven culture while also maintaining personal health and wellness that often suffers due to the workload?
I love that. And you know what? As a principal, I was always a huge advocate of putting pressure on my teachers to do both. So it's not just pressure to focus on achievement and pressure to get the work done and pressure to, you know, be exceptional instructionally. It's also pressure to go home at a reasonable hour. It's pressure to exercise. It's pressure to eat well. So I think that we have to have a roadmap for ourselves as human beings to be able to understand what a healthy lifestyle looks like, what healthy work balance looks like, because everybody's work balance, work-life balance is going to be different. So we just have to be able to map out exactly what that means, what it looks like, and then, you know, mind, body, and spirit, have an action plan for each component of your life so that you're doing the things you need to do. As a principal, I started fitness challenges with my faculty. The staff lounge was always one of my favorite places to go in and scoop up all the donuts and put down veggie platters. I mean, things like that. it sounds silly, but I think we all know if you put food in front of most educators, they'll eat.
Yep.
It doesn't matter what it is. And that's just because we have 45 seconds to grab something to eat and go, so we're not pretty non-discriminatory when it comes to our snacking. So if we put healthy snacks in front of people, they'll eat healthy snacks. I think we need to do stuff like that. I mean, Friday afternoons, I was famous for making an announcement on the PA system that the school district was coming over to repave our staff parking lot. So all the carts need to be out of there. Take them home. Get them out of there. Just so folks didn't stay too long on a Friday afternoon after the hard work week. They needed to go, you know, they go spend time with their family, go for a walk, go garden, go do something. So as part of my work as a capacity builder, and I do believe our professional/personal lines blur at times, I encourage folks to take up hobbies and to, I had a staff member that I worked with a couple years ago who, was dissatisfied with his body mass index, his weight. He wanted to lose some weight, wanted to get in shape. And so I challenged him to train and then compete in a Tough Mudder, which is, I don't know if you know about that. It's a 10-mile kind of cross-country road race that has 25 obstacles in it with ice-cold water and barbed wire and crawling in mud and that kind of stuff. And this is a guy that had no desire to do anything like that at all, but he was able to get to the point where he was running 6-7 miles, and we did that. We did that event. So those kind of things, I think we're responsible for our folks' well-being. We're responsible for their health, their happiness, because they're not going to be good to numbers 2 through 65 if they're not good to number 1.
Thank you. So I know you're up against time. If you can answer one more question, I'm going to skip
sure.
to number seven, if that's okay. And
sure.
And it's so
actually,
what
you know,
recommendation?
I have a little bit more time, and I kind of like number six, too.
Okay. So let me
you don't mind.
Stick.
I mean,
well, you know what? All right. So, what recommendations do you have for providing teachers data analysis training?
All right. So here's
is that the one
you're
talking? Is that that's the number six you're
yeah.
talking about, correct?
Yeah, that's the number six I'm talking about. I love that. just the idea for folks that have not yet been initiated into data training and numbers and spreadsheets and graphs and you know all that kind of stuff. The whole idea sounds very foreign, very scary, very intimidating. Really, I think probably what is the simplest way to engage in this work is to pick a protocol, pick a data-driven dialogue protocol, a simple one, and then stick with it. Just use that one. Every time you analyze data, at least for a while, just use the same protocol. And we have one that some colleagues and I published in a book called The Principal Influence. It's called the Data-Driven Dialogue Protocol, standard protocol. It's predict the data, analyze the data, or predict the data, make notes, what do you notice of the data, and then make some analysis of why you think they might be, and then create a plan. What are you going to do about it? And it's pretty simple to follow that plan, and you can get as creative and divergent as you want to from that base. The problem becomes when every time we analyze data, if there's a different protocol that we're following and we're doing something a little bit differently, nobody gets in the swing of what we're really trying to do and how it's going to impact our practice. So if we pick something really simple like that and just use it and use it again and use it every time, we're much more likely to become familiar, A, with the protocol and then, B, with the outcome, which is we're trying to figure out what do our kids know? Where are we trying to get them? And then what's our plan for getting them there? And we can do that very simply. It doesn't take complicated metrics and all these programs and formulas and spreadsheets to do that. We can do that on our own through a very simple protocol. So that's my piece of advice for the administrators out there and the leaders out there is to keep it simple, right? Keep it simple.
Okay. Thank you for that. I'm going
You're
to
welcome.
Get a copy of your book, too. I'm going to have Allison pay for it. Out of
There you go. Now you're
sure.
talking.
So, what recommendations do you have for supporting teachers through the data analysis discussions, especially when they're not seeing the results desired? So basically, how do you keep up the teacher's perseverance? As you know, a lot of times teachers do everything right and the results are slow to come, even when they do things properly.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm a big sports fan. I think there's a bazillion sports metaphors that work for everything, but I have seen the greatest quarterbacks throw interceptions, and I've seen the greatest receivers drop balls, and I've seen the greatest batters strike out, and I've seen the greatest pitchers give up home runs. And sometimes we have to remember we're talking about a long-term end game with education. The results, we're not always going to get the exact results that we expect and that we want first go around, second go around, early on. And we need to be transparent and upfront and clear and open about the process that we're going through. Every process has bumps and it's got pitfalls and it's got obstacles and it's got things that delay us. We just need to know that they're going to happen. It's kind of like running a wedding. You know, if you've ever been to a wedding, something's going to go wrong. You don't know what it is. You just expect that at some point something's going to go wrong. You just prepare yourself and brace yourself for that reality so that you can, when it happens, you can just kind of cushion the blow and then move forward. And that's kind of what we do when we look at instruction and data analysis and looking at the results of our assessments is we know that some things are going to go well. We know some things are not going to go well. We just need to be willing to keep our minds open to it and learn. There's a terrific, I don't know where it is. There's a terrific article that talks about the process of school improvement. And I have created, along with that, kind of a line graph, and I can send it to you. This line graph shows the process of school improvement, but it's pretty applicable no matter what context you're working, that shows the different steps that we can all kind of assume are going to happen. And when you know that there's going to be a plateau, and when you know you're going to have to do something a little differently as a result, you can be aware of the fact that, hey, we're at a plateau right now. And so according to our process, we know that this we knew this plateau was coming. We've hit the plateau, and now what we need to do is we need to get external help. We have maximized the knowledge in-house, and we're going to need to get, you know, another resource for us. Maybe we need some professional development. Maybe we need to do a book study on something. We need to get some external help that'll move us to the next level. And when you know that's coming, and then you see that it's happening, everyone understands it, and that it's not this sense of dismay that envelops the staff. It becomes a very pragmatic, understandable process that, okay, here we are. Here's what we need to do next. And then you move forward. So if you'd like, I can send you that. It's really
good. I would love that, actually. That would be great.
It puts
and then I will forward it to everybody else.
Absolutely. Sure, I'll be happy to do that.
Do you have time for one more?
Sure.
Okay, so, and I want to be conscious of your time, but so and you'll have to, because I put some follow-up questions in mind, so I lost the numbering. But I think the next one was talked about what recommendations do you have for supporting teachers through the data analysis discussions. That's the one I just had. How does an administrator create a risk-free environment for staff to pursue the challenges of increasing rigor in lessons?
Yeah, that's the next one. Creating a risk-free environment, it comes back to relationships. It comes back to trust. It comes back to the notion that in order for us to grow, we have to do things differently. And if we're going to do things differently, there's going to be a learning process. There's going to be we're going to stumble. We're going to make mistakes. That's where the great learning comes from. We have to be okay with that. And as leaders, probably the single greatest thing we can do to help foster that environment is to be vulnerable in front of our staff. So when we make mistakes, you just got to stand in front of the troops and wear it. You know, you just have to admit that, hey, this is what I did. This is why I did it. This is what I thought was going to happen. Boy, was I wrong. This is what actually happened. What a screw up. Here's my plan for making it better. And the reason I'm sharing this with you is because I don't want you all to be afraid to make mistakes. In fact, I want you to seek out new ways to do things to get better results. And I totally understand that if you're doing that, you're going to struggle at times. You're going to stumble and fall. Things are going to go haywire. And we need to be willing to look at each other and support each other as we do that. So I'm modeling it for you. I'm showing you that, hey, I screwed up. It's not the end of the world. We're going to move forward. Maybe it cost us some money. Maybe it cost us some resources. Who knows what the cost is. But when we do that as leaders and we create that vulnerability and we show them that vulnerability, that's when we're most likely to have folks that are going to be willing to take risks and willing to try things out. And then, you know, you build a culture of collaboration where folks are willing to do it together and learn from each other and analyze their path, analyze their mistakes, just try to figure out where it went wrong so they can do it better next time. I mean, that's powerful when we can create those environments. So it all does start at the top. I mean, we can say as much as we want that we just need a teacher to do it, but really it comes back to the leader being the one that has to model that first so that everybody knows, okay, that's what it looks like, that's what it sounds like, and it's okay. And then it's been modeled for everybody, and now it's on the table. Something we can talk about, and as we move forward, that's just the way it's going to be.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking your time out for the group. Your information was fantastic, and we're going to make that recording available for everyone so they could be inspired as we were. I really appreciate your time. And hopefully our paths will cross. I will send you my email, and then if you can send me that chart, I'll forward that on to the group as well.
Okay, and I think you received it on...
Yeah.
You were CC'd on Allison's email, so I'll just reply all, and then I'll just send it out to you guys.
Thank you.
That's perfect.
Our work is ongoing for the next year. So we'll keep you updated on what these school leaders come up with.
Sure. I appreciate that. And can you also make the recording available to me? Because I might like to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll kind of replay some things. Sure, I appreciate that. All righty.
Cool.
Well, thanks for including me. I appreciate the invitation and, you know, always happy to help out.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And if I ever see you at a conference or anything or see you there, I will try to wait patiently and introduce myself so you can put a face with your name and I can do the same. And
you just,
I would
you
love to meet you.
You push ahead of the throngs. You just get all those people out of the way and you come up with it.
Thank you so much, Pete. Have a great rest of your week.
You too.
All right, team. Thanks. You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.